overwhelmed.
But I'd better say this first, if I can get it, I normally do. The fire exits are there and there, and if you could turn your mobile phones off, that would be a great help. So today we're here for the C.P. Snow Lecture. C.P. Snow was a fellow of the college. He came here from Leicester after school and university there, and he became a fellow of Christ's in 1930. After his early career as a scientist, he served in several senior positions in government as technical director of the Ministry of Labour from 1940 to 1944, during the war effort, a civil service commissioner from 1945 to 1960, and in Parliament as parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Technology from 1964 to 1966. He became a life peer, Baron Snow, in 1964. He married the novelist Pamela Hansford Johnson in 1950, and those of you that saw the poster for the talk, that was a poster of them on their wedding day just after leaving the chapel in Christ's. He had a varied career, and as a novelist, he wrote a number of books. Perhaps he's best known for his sequence of novels entitled Strangers and Brothers, depicting intellectuals in academic and government settings in the modern era. The Masters is the best known novel of the sequence. It deals with the internal politics of a Cambridge college as it prepares to elect a new master, and it's compulsory reading for Fellows of Christ's in advance of mastership elections. a later novel in the sequence, based on his time in Whitehall, is Corridors of Power, added that phrase to our language. 50 years ago, Snow delivered an influential Reed lecture in Cambridge called The Two Cultures, which provoked widespread and heated debate, I think is the best way I could summarise it. This was subsequently published as The Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution, and the lecturer argued that the breakdown of communication between the two cultures of modern society, as Snow saw them, the sciences and the humanities, that breakdown was a major hindrance to solving the world's problems. On this 50th anniversary of that lecture, we're delighted to welcome back to Christ's Professor Lisa Jardine. Lisa's Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary, London, as well as many other things. Her books have included Ingenious Pursuits, Building the Scientific Revolution, as well as works on Francis Bacon, Christopher Wren, and Robert Hooke. She's well known also for her penetrating and entertaining Radio 4 slots, which often tackle current day aspects of science, technology and society, and of the tensions between. Her recent Tanner lectures in Cambridge were entitled What's Left of Culture and Society, and addressed another aspect of the interaction between society and technology. For the past 18 months, she's been chair of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, and I suspect that her experience there of the interplay between society, culture, and scientific and technological advance will inform this lecture. Lisa, it's a great pleasure to welcome you here, and your title today is C.P. Snow's Two Cultures Revisited.
I will try and master all the various technology here. Thank you very much for coming this evening, and thank you to Christ for inviting me to give this lecture. It fits very nicely into my current thinking, because I'm actually currently working on what will, I guess, ultimately be a book about my own father, David Bronowski. And the bit that I'm working on at the moment is the war years, during which my father worked on the strategic bombing initiative alongside a number of other physicists and mathematicians. So you may hear kind of echoes of concerns in this C.P. Snow lecture. I start with this Michael Ayrton drawing of C.P. Snow made in 1963. I'm hearing, as I move away, as if the mic is, and I'm moving off mic, shall I move it around a bit? Is that okay? It's in the middle now. That should be better. We're here this evening to reflect upon the fact that 50 years ago this year, on the 7th of May, 1959, A distinguished alumnus of this college, Charles Percy Snow, C.P. Snow, delivered the Reed Lecture here in Cambridge under the title The Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution. In it, Snow, a moderately able research chemist who had become a successful novelist and who was, at the time of writing, a government official, brought to public attention what he considered to be a dangerous divide between the ethos, outlook, and practices of the sciences and those of the old humanities. That lecture ignited a debate about the relative importance for British culture of the arts and sciences and permanently enshrined the phrase the two cultures in popular parlance. Snow's text was rushed out for publication in the same year and has rarely been out of print since. To judge from the number of events on the topic which have been hosted around the English-speaking world in this anniversary year, the argument remains current and continues to generate considerable amounts of energetic, not to say agitated, debate. In the tradition of long-running disputes, neither side has, then or now, been prepared to concede much ground, and the practitioners of the two intellectual spheres remain myopically as far apart as they were 50 years ago. Perhaps presumptuously, in view of the amount of ink that has been spilled on the so-called art, science, culture wars, I'm going to suggest in this lecture that almost since the day it was delivered, Snow's original lecture has actually been taken out of its context, its real significance as a timely intervention diminished. Instead, it's been annexed to a parochial squabble between academic disciplines, largely conducted, that quarrel tends now to be conducted, within the humanities. I think the scientists lost interest in it a good while ago. The situation has not been helped by our allowing a ferocious ad hominem attack on Snow himself by a Cambridge academic with a taste for controversy to hijack the subsequent debate and actually define the terms of engagement. Read in context, I shall argue, Snow was frankly not interested in whether the plays of Shakespeare or the second law of thermodynamics was the more appropriate starting point for a full and rich understanding of contemporary Britain, its community and culture. Nor was the focus of his attention where the scientists who could explain that second law of thermodynamics or the humanities trained who could quote Shakespeare at will were to be preferred as pillars of a civilized society. In fact, I'm going to suggest that the lecture Snow gave in 1959 was the culmination, rather than the beginning, of a post-war debate about the role of science in British society. It was an argument which had begun in the final years of the Second World War and had been enlarged on and developed in the course of the 1950s in the context of discussion about the direction Britain should take in manufacturing and technology as the country came off a war footing. That debate eventually crystallized in Snow's mind in 1960, a year after the Reed Lecture, into a series of lectures he delivered at Harvard and which were published in 1961 under the title Science and Government. No, you could tell my affiliation by the rather awful picture I found of Ben Barlees, which is the best I could do in high res on Google. F.R. Leavis, Snow's bitter Cambridge adversary in the two cultures debate, makes no reference to science and government in his own Richmond lecture, delivered at Downing College, from which he was shortly to retire, and published in The Spectator in March 1962. There's actually no reason to believe that Leavis had even read Science and Government, since it did not address the parochial themes inadvertently introduced by the unsuspecting Snow in The Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution. Snow's argument, I shall maintain, was framed in the critical years after the end of the Second World War and was meant as an urgent appeal to those who were shaping the policies and priorities of the post-war English-speaking world. The urgency of the question is, in fact, to be detected in the Two Cultures lecture, in spite of its sometimes annoyingly bantering tone, in the repeated, "I intend something serious here." He says that twice in the opening paragraphs, "I intend something serious here." And in Snow's reiterated claims in that lecture that the fracture across the humanities science divide introduces a fatal flaw into contemporary planning for Britain's future purpose and prosperity. I don't know who the man is who's asleep. Does anyone know who the man is? A single passage from the Reed lecture, so this is actually the only passage I quote from the Two Cultures lecture, sets the more serious tone which I'm going to take up and pursue here. Snow says, "I believe the pole of total incomprehension of science radiates its influence on all the rest. That total incomprehension gives much more persuasively than we realize living in it an unscientific flavor to the whole traditional culture. It is the traditional culture, to an extent remarkably little diminished by the emergence of the scientific one, which manages the Western world." And I slightly stressed that myself. "This polarization," Snow goes on, "is sheer loss to us all, to us as people and to our society. The degree of incomprehension on both sides is a joke which has gone sour." So, as I said, this discussion had its origin in the immediately post-war period. So let's go back about 10 years before Snow's landmark lecture to a point where we can actually, I think, detect the clash of cultures Snow wanted to alert his audience to, already beginning to crystallize. The moment in question is what appears to be a wholehearted endorsement of Britain's global aspirations in science, art, and design together, the Festival of Britain. Here is how two historians of the festival characterize the process whereby the Festival of Britain came to be realized as the country emerged from the Second World War. The essential background of the festival was the post-war Labour government and the creation of the welfare state. In the foreground were the new councils and cultural bodies set up with the aim of revitalizing British life. A 1951 exhibition was first proposed by the Royal Society of Arts as early as 1943, while the war was still going on. In fact, an astonishing affirmation of hope for an Allied victory. Then, in September 1945, with the war over and Labour in power, Gerald Barry, the editor of the News Chronicle, addressed an open letter to Stafford Cripps, then President of the Board of Trade, advocating a trade and cultural exhibition in London as a way of commemorating the centenary of the Crystal Palace. The Festival of Britain emerged as a definite proposition in 1947-8, in part to commemorate the great exhibition, and in part to signal a relief from unparalleled austerity, a sort of jollification at the end of that austerity. The headquarters was in the Treasury, not surprisingly, given the economic straitjacket of the period, with an exhibition unit set up in the Central Office of Information. In April 1949, the two were merged to form the Festival of Britain Office, with Gerald Barry, that's the editor of the News Chronicle, appointed Director General under the chairmanship of General Lord Ismay. Now, in spite of that affirmation in the process of planning, and I could tell you at more length about how economic factors and logistics interfered with the grander schemes for the grandest schemes of the exhibition, there is nevertheless detectable unease in the transition that the Festival of Britain attempts to make from an old British culture rooted in classic art and literature and a hoped-for new Britain built on a foundation of trade and commerce, science and technology. In its eventual execution, the festival's exhibitions preserve as a kind of frozen moment the dilemma faced by those seeking to promote a new science-based culture as the promise for a prosperous, renewed, and regenerated Britain in the years in which Europe emerged bruised and battered from a state of war. The government's agenda for the festival as a whole, supported by all the political parties, was to celebrate a new dawn of prosperity and progress and to put the war years resolutely behind them. This determination inflected every aspect of the festival. And thereby, and this is really what I'm asking you to give your attention to, it helps us to focus our retrospective attention on some lasting consequences of the way that agenda developed. And I'm arguing that those lasting consequences of a dilemma and a divide are where Snow finds himself as he tries to articulate an argument that he makes in 1959 to 1960. And because I always like my audiences to know where I'm going to argue that we haven't got very far since, and it's about time we try again. Ian Cox, director of science and organizer of the Festival Traveling Exhibitions, who'd been seconded to the project from the Central Office for Information, that is, from the government, describes the rationale behind the festival's two London exhibitions, which were the festival's centerpiece, the one on the South Bank site, the other in South Kensington. He describes that in the South Bank exhibition catalogue as follows. The exhibition was designed to demonstrate, this is the South Bank exhibition, was designed to demonstrate the contributions to civilization made by British advances in science, technology and industrial design, and it was clearly necessary they should be exhibited in their practical and applied forms against the background representing the living, working world of today. It was to provide such a setting for the presentation of this theme that the South Bank exhibition was conceived. And this is the sea and ship section of the South Bank exhibition. I remember, how many people here remember that the festival museum? All I remember is the machine that put the letters inside Festival of Britain Rock. And the other person I consulted as to what she remembered that the llama ate her hair ribbons in the children's zoo corner. So it clearly made a remarkable impact on us. So this is the South Bank exhibition. In the catalogue to the South Kensington Science Exhibition, Cox explains that two exhibitions are designed with complementary goals. And he says, on the South Bank, British achievement in science is illustrated by its practical applications in the modern world. But these applications all arise from a background of fundamental knowledge to which the so-called pure scientists are adding all the time by experiment and observation. Even without its applications, this knowledge is of incalculable value, for in a unique way, it goes on widening the horizons of human thought, offering it whole new territories of beauty and order to explore. It is to show something of this aspect and achievement of science that the science exhibition has been conceived. And this is the cover of the science exhibition brochure. The other has the tan cover. I bought mint copies of both of these on EBE books for 50p. Absolutely extraordinary. And they are absolutely well worth having. They absolutely capture a moment in British history. The images really say it all. But I decided not to make this too much of an image lecture. So those are two quotes from from the catalogues, what the brochures, what the objectives were as far as the public was concerned. In spite of their accessible, almost charmingly ordinary language clarity, the catalogues for the Festival of Britain make odd reading. At their heart is an evasion which disturbs the surface smoothness of the carefully crafted narratives. On the one hand, extraordinary care is taken to underline the tight connection between pure science and its applications in everyday life. On the other, an equivalent amount of care has gone into making sure that there is barely a mention of the most recent and richest location for demonstrating the potentially fruitful outcome of such a tight application of pure science to useful ends, the way rapid development and application of research science to the development of military technology had given the Allies the edge over Hitler. So, for example, radar, that most brilliant and successful British wartime scientific advance, makes a single brief appearance in the section of the South Bank exhibition entitled Transport and Communications. But the context for its accelerated realization is simply touched on and then immediately moved on from. The catch and runs, British scientists developed radar in the first instance to meet a military need, but now it is being freely applied for civic purposes. This section will show how it is used for supervising aircraft from the ground or vessels from the shore, and how it aids the navigation of aircraft and ships, whether in daylight, darkness, or fog. The watchword at the Festival of Britain was apparently, "Don't mention the war." Both on the part of the committee charged with mounting the Festival of Britain exhibitions and in their execution. And, I mean, it's actually, that's why I should really have reproduced the entire brochures for you. In the entire brochures, and I think I might have one image, here. These are the advertisements. The most fascinating things in the brochures are the advertisements. In the entire two brochures, here of course we have the festival, what do we get out of technology? The radio, of course, an absolutely beloved household object coming out of essentially the war effort. But in the entire two brochures, there is only one image in any of the very technological, scientific, and technological and scientific advertisements. Everybody's got into the spirit of the thing. And that is, not surprisingly, one for aircraft engines, in which the text is all about civil aviation, but the picture, rather nice watercolour, is of a row of Spitfires with boys in uniform on, but no mention is made of that. No mention. So I'm overstating it slightly, but you have to sort of take this sort of on board for my argument. There is no mention of the war. The year is 1951. To recognise how self-conscious this omission is, we need only recall that wartime food rationing, specifically sugar and butter, didn't end until 1954, 2 years after the end of the festival. In 1951, as the exhibition opened, Britain entered the Korean War, sending troops in as part of the UN's intervention there. The threat of nuclear war hung over the West as part of the Cold War. 6 months earlier, at the end of 1950, President Truman took the decision to proceed with tests of the hydrogen bomb. The first atmospheric test took place at the beginning of 1952, and of course the critical test on the Bikini Atoll in 1954. Politically, Britain was in turmoil. The Labour government, whose brainchild the festival was to provide what Herbert Morrison called wonderfully a tonic to the nation at the end of a long period of austerity, the Labour government fell in October 1951. So, while the festival was still going on. The new Prime Minister Winston Churchill's general antipathy towards the whole project was given solid foundation with the death of King George VI in early February 1952. The demolition of the temporary festival buildings was accelerated at actually quite unseemly haste in order to provide open green space for the celebrations planned for the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. In the Festival of Britain exhibitions, as in most public pronouncements made on science and society in Britain in the late 1940s, there is a real reluctance to recognise the role pure science has played in the Allied victory. Now, of course, I don't mean in scientific circles, but I mean there is what I think is a damaging reluctance to bring that into discussions about the future of science in the context of Britain's commercial, technological, and scientific future. As a consequence, science is celebrated as the source of emancipation, liberation, and progress, but the context which has formed that moment is left out. And yet, almost all those associated with the two exhibitions had worked on wartime scientific developments, including radar, strategic bombing, and ultimately the atomic bomb. Snow himself had been involved with the recruitment of scientists for government positions throughout the war, thereby connecting at first hand with the major contribution research science made to what he refers to as the gadgets and strategies that eventually won the war. There could hardly be a clearer example of deliberate amnesia than in the case of the chairman of the Festival of Britain Committee, General Hastings Ismay, who had been created Lord Ismay for his wartime services in 1947. and then chaired the festival committee from 1948 to 1951. Lord Ismay had been Winston Churchill's chief military assistant throughout the Second World War and a close personal friend of the Prime Minister. He later served as the first Secretary-General of NATO from 1952 to 1957, and indeed, if you consult that august, reference source, Google, Wikipedia, you will find that Festival of Britain, he's a military man, and the Festival of Britain makes it into a footnote. I'm just going to pour myself a glass of water. Have a little cough. I'll do that. Oh, that's very nice. So remember, what did I do with my other? Oh, here we are. I'm talking about Lord Ismay, remember? Ismay had been at Churchill's side throughout the war, advising him on all key strategic military matters, and ultimately, in conjunction with Lord Cherwell, Lindemann, of whom more shortly, endorsing the decision to drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the grounds that this would bring the war with Japan to a swift end. The editor of the News Chronicle and prime mover behind the Festival of Britain published his open letter calling for a celebration of British achievements, past, present and future, just over a month after the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. It's hard not to feel that as the enormity of the largely uncomprehended consequences in terms of civilian casualties and the horrific nature of the deaths and injuries cast a shadow over Gerald, it's hard not to feel that the enormity of that cast a shadow over Gerald Barry's forward-looking agenda, and I'm suggesting that it was completely impossible to be upbeat and bullish and triumphalist about the future of the science for instance, my father went into Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 3 months after the bombs were dropped, and everybody understood what had happened. Now I'm going to say that it's very, very important for what Snow has to say. I'm not, hand-wringing about the dropping of the bombs. I'm saying it creates a kind of hiatus in the argument that's being made in Britain about moving forward in science. And I'm actually suggesting it's a hiatus we haven't kind of overcome, and that by hijacking Snow's extremely timely intervention, I think that science and government was extraordinarily timely, and was in fact a restatement of what he'd been wanting to say in the Reed lecture, that we missed the point about something which I think is quite peculiar to Britain at the beginning of the 21st century as a result of the second half of the 20th. So for me, a very rather new but very serious argument. If science was to be represented, this is Gerald Barry, left-wing newspaper editor, wanting terribly to sweep Britain forward on the promise, all the expectation of those unbelievable advances. Just take how fast radar was developed and the way that it was used, just the way it was deployed and the way teams of people worked in Britain together and understood it and moved forward. He has that promise, but he also has the atomic bomb at its back. If science was to be represented as holding the key promise to Britain's future, he must surely have believed it ought to be a science that was not associated with the enormity of the unimaginable scale of human suffering of those final weeks of the war with Japan. It was, I suggest, in suppressing the connection between the wartime activities of research scientists and their activities in peacetime that the organisers of the Festival of Britain created a confusion at the heart of the public's engagement with the new science and a confusion at the heart of subsequent discussions among administrators and educationalists concerning the place pure science should play, have in British life and in British thought as a whole, and particularly in education, and its function as part of Britain's post-war greatness. There's a detectable failure of nerve, I'm saying, around 1950, which is clearly visible in the realisation of the Festival of Britain, in spite of its alleged science and technology emphasis. You can see this most charmingly, you have a charm break here, in the at once modern and nostalgic designs for textiles, wallpapers and ceramics commissioned for the festival. Probably its most lasting visible influence. So these designs were developed in collaboration between scientists like Bragg, great scientists working in their labs with new molecules, who produced scale drawings in order that the fabric designers could design fabrics and chair covers and wall hangings, and my favourite, very nice ceramics. But do you see that in a sense that dodges the question? It is a relationship between art, science and design, but it sort of dodges the question about what the productive relates. It's a productive relationship between the arts and the sciences. And those who were engaged in it enjoyed it enormously, and I think the outcomes are really rather wonderful. And we're just refurnishing our flat, and we're definitely using some of these designs. They've come right around again. 50 years later, they've come right around again. So that's probably, I'm leaving those plates for a minute. Meanwhile, the period between the end of 1945 and 1959, so now I'm moving between 45 and 59, when Snow delivered his Two Cultures lecture, was one during which successive British governments seemed to have lost confidence in the educational centrality of science. Some of that, of course, had to do with the Labour government falling and a really very backward-looking Conservative government coming in, and you could track within discussions in government level about education some of that nostalgic thrown back and the exclusion of science. But I don't want to put it at a political level. I think generally successive governments from the end of the war through the 50s lost confidence in the educational centrality of science. And they opted instead for extending a traditional version of elite education to the population, to a larger population. So it became an issue of delivering the humanities that had been for an elite at a level that was that remained at no dumbing down, a non-dumbed down version of the humanities, delivering it that now to a much larger section of the population. But the focus gets turned to that, I'm suggesting, and science gets quietly left to one side. Whereas, as I know from my own relatives who came as refugees, if you come as with nothing, not even the language, you can go, as my father did, from coming at 12 with not a word of English to getting a scholarship in mathematics to Cambridge at 18, you certainly can't go from not having a word of English at 11 to getting a place to read English, but or history, or but English. I'm not dissing them, I'm just making a... In terms of wanting wider access to education, which was very, very clearly the post-war aim, we turned away from a science education and concentrated on broadening the reach of an arts education. That trend was briefly interrupted by the five months, razzmatazz of the Festival of Britain, during which almost 8.5 million people visited the South Bank exhibition, and over 200,000 the South Kensington Pure Science Exhibition. Even so, the, you might call it, bread and circuses of the South Bank exhibition and the associated Battersea Pleasure Gardens, because there was a shuttle between them, attracted a dramatically larger audience than the one at South Kensington, where the new pure fields of particle physics and molecular biology were being entertainingly explained. And it was only in the course of researching this lecture that I discovered that my father wrote the catalogue for that exhibition. I mean, his name's at the end of it. That's the only reason I know. It
wasn't very difficult research.
So. With the exception of the Festival of Britain, the post-war mood in Britain was fundamentally backward-looking in its aspiration to widen access to knowledge and all things intellectual. Initiatives for raising the ambition of the population, like the Third Programme, which began broadcasting in September 1946, were grand in their aspiration to offer a wide audience among the British general public a diet of high culture, but that culture was resolutely traditional. The BBC Gore goal was a new inclusiveness for its audience. And this is how the Director General of the BBC describes that purpose of the Third Programme in the Radio Times for came out in the week that the Third Programme came on the airwaves. He says, "The Third Programme will have no fixed points. It will devote to the great works the time they require. It will seek every evening to do something that is culturally satisfying and significant. It will devote occasional series of evenings to some related masterpieces, a Shakespeare historical cycle, or the Beethoven quartets, or a series of Mozart operas. It will, so far as circumstances permit, be international. Concerts, operas, plays will be taken from abroad as landline conditions improve. Its talks will include contributions from the great European thinkers. Its whole content will be directed to an audience that is not of one class, but that is perceptive and intelligent. The civilizing power of art and music is to bind the classes together into a perceptive and intelligent whole, poised to move forward into a new age of promise. And in the classroom, in the new era of free education for all following the 1944 Education Act, this humane initiation into what had traditionally been an entirely elite sphere was held up as the gold standard to which the talented grammar school boy or girl might aspire." Yet the period 1939 to 1945 had shown clearly that there were crucial decisions to be taken by those in high places for which a traditional education, however civilized, was not an adequate or sufficient preparation. In the new Britain, how were those who had risen to the top of the social hierarchy through their engagement with great art and literature to decide, for instance, whether or not to authorize public expenditure on the hydrogen bomb or on the peacetime use of nuclear energy? How indeed were those at government level charged with rebuilding Britain's peacetime industry to make choices about where to concentrate investment, or those in charge of the new National Health Service to decide what medical areas to fund? Thought we'd like to have this again. This is the context for Snow's Two Cultures lecture. Behind the Oxford anecdotes, which so infuriated FR leaders, there lies a serious, not to say urgent, question. How are informed decisions to be made about matters as important as the development and use of nuclear weapons, or in our own time, to decide on strategies designed to save the entire planet from man-made destruction, if successive governments stress the humanizing effects of traditional high culture, and if the education required to enter the governing elite does not include a scientific training? Some of you may have seen an article by Mark Henderson, as it happens this week, Time Science correspondent, pointing out that when Ian Gibson stood down from Parliament, and when Evan Harris and one other, John Sedley, I think, lose their seats because they're in marginal for the next election, there will be no trained scientists in the House of Commons. Give that back. Actually, let me not put that so dramatic. He says 460 of the 600 MPs has a BA, and of the BSCs, a very large proportion, possibly most, are from places like the LSE and are in social sciences, economics, and so on. Now, as I said, the shape of Snow's argument in Two Cultures is blurred by its tone, well, I haven't quoted it because it's really annoying, and muffled by subsequent ill-natured controversy. For confirmation that this is indeed the debate Snow wanted to launch, I'm going to spend the remainder of the lecture looking at the fuller treatment he gave in the year after he delivered the Reid lecture, but remember, a year before FR leaders attacked him, in his God-given lectures at Harvard. We live, he writes, in science and government. That's what the letters, those lectures were called, and they're longer. There were a series of lectures, not a single lecture. We live, he writes, in times when vital political decisions have to be made, for which specialist scientific understanding is essential, this is 1960, remember, but for which those charged with taking the decisions have not been prepared. And I quote, "One of the most bizarre features of any advanced industrial society in our time is that the cardinal choices have been made by a handful of men, in secret, and by men who cannot have a first-hand knowledge of what those choices depend upon, or what their results may be." He has in mind, and he specifies a sentence later, decisions which determine in the crudest sense whether we live or die, and he goes on to name some of them. In recent British history, he says, they have included the choice in England and the United States in 1940 and 1941 to go ahead with work on the fission bomb, the choice in 1945 to use that bomb when it was made, the choice of the United States and the Soviet Union in the late 40s to make the fusion bomb, the choice which led to a different result in the United States and the Soviet Union about intercontinental missiles. Snow then goes on to extend from the military sphere into what you might call the NHS current sphere. He extends his rubric about things that have to be decided by which we live or die as follows. "It is in the making of weapons of absolute destruction that you can see my central theme at its sharpest and most dramatic, but the same reflections would apply to a whole assembly of decisions which are not designed to do harm. For example, some of the most important choices about a nation's physical health are made or not made by a handful of men in secret, and by men who normally are not able to comprehend the arguments in depth." In the body of the Godkin lectures, Snow dramatizes, in a very novelistic way, what it means for a handful of men to take decisions vital for the nation by means of a narrative based on a real-life confrontation between two erstwhile friends and scientific colleagues during the war. His hero and villain are, respectively, the chemist Henry Tizard and the physicist Frederick Lindemann, later Lord Cherwell. Both were high-level wartime scientific advisors entrusted with decisions on the strength of which the war might have been won or lost. Tizard was responsible for the accelerated development of radar in the early war years. Lindemann set up the statistical office, among whose calculations crucial to the war effort were those on how to achieve the maximum impact with bomb sizes and delivery, and for which my father worked. Ultimately, however, it was Lord Cherwell who became the very first official chief scientific advisor, and he who persuaded Churchill to adopt the strategic bombing initiative of Germany for the second half of the war, mathematically calculated saturation bombing of civilian targets in dense urban areas. We're not discussing the ethics here, we're discussing the statistics. The two men fell out conclusively, Snow recounts, in 1942 over the policy decision to adopt the statistical office's calculations in support of strategic bombing, in spite of considerable internal opposition, notably from Tizard and Blackett. Lindemann, now Lord Cherwell and a member of the cabinet, I'm taking all of this straight out of this novelistic treatment in Snow's lectures. Lindemann, now Lord Cherwell, a member of the cabinet, produced the scientific paper which formed the basis for that decision, and Snow quotes this passage from it, which deserves being listened to. "It described in quantitative terms," Snow writes, "the effect on Germany of a British bombing offensive in the next 18 months, approximately March 1942 to September 1943. The paper laid down a strategic policy. The bombing must be directed essentially against German working class houses. Middle class houses had too much space around them and are bound to waste bombs. Factories and military objectives had long since been forgotten, except in official bulletins, since they were much too difficult to find and hit." In the course of this, I discovered, as some of you probably know, that what counted as a hit before we had laser-guided missiles was within 5 miles of the target. The paper claimed that, given a total concentration of effort on the production and use of bombing aircraft, it would be possible in all the larger towns in Germany, that is those with more than 50,000 inhabitants, to destroy 50% of all houses. The issue here, Snow hastens to explain, is not the ethics of the proposal, though even by 1960, he admits the reader is likely to find the discussion, a discussion like this, morally distasteful. It was, I quote, his calculations. It was the assumptions made for statistical purposes and the mathematics itself that formed the basis for the quarrel with Tizard and also with Blackett. Quote, the paper went to Tizard. He studied the statistics. He came to the conclusion quite impregnably that Lindemann's estimate of the number of houses that could possibly be destroyed was 5 times too high. Everyone agreed that if the amount of possible destruction was as low as that calculated by Tizard, the bombing offensive was not worth concentrating on. We should have to find a different strategy. In fact, Snow tells his Harvard audience, the bombing survey after the war, that is the assessment of damage after the war, revealed that Lindemann's estimate had been 10 times too high, that he'd got it wrong. His office had got it wrong. But Lindemann, Lord Cherwell, was the man at Churchill's side, and he convinced the cabinet that strategic bombing was the right policy to pursue. For the rest of the war, air power that was badly needed, for example, to escort convoys of supply ships, was diverted to concentrate on saturation aerial bombardment of Germany. In a postscript, another separate publication to Science and Government, which Snow published a year after the first, so in 1962, he quotes from an article published in Scientific American in 1961 by Blackett in the light of the post-war analysis. It reads, this is Blackett speaking, without a doubt, the area bombing offensive was an expensive failure. About 500,000 German men, women, and children were killed, but in the bombing offensive, 160,000 airmen were lost. German war production went on rising. I confess, says Blackett, to a haunting sense of personal failure, and I'm sure that Tizard felt the same way. If we had only been more persuasive, and had forced people to believe our simple arithmetic, might we not have changed this decision? As chief scientific advisor with a seat at the cabinet table, Lord Cherwell's view prevailed. The opponents to strategic bombing were silenced, according to Snow, because one man, trusted by a prime minister without mathematical training to agree or disagree with the calculations on which the decision was to be taken, was given the final say. No one, says Snow, however expert, however highly regarded, should ever be allowed that amount of license without other presentation of evidence and other argued positions being reviewed. He concludes, and it's the conclusion of his lectures for Clocking. If you are going to have a scientist in a position of isolated power, the only scientist among non-scientists, it is dangerous whoever he is, and he's underscored that. This was the lesson which burnt itself in upon many during the controversies of 1939 to 1945. Whoever he is, whether he is the wisest scientist in the world, we must never tolerate a scientific overlord again. Snow is not here advocating government by teams of boffins, or a society defined by its mastery of military hardware, like the Soviet Union at the time. I put that sentence in because I read a bit of this to my daughter, arts, largely arts training, and she went, oh, you're not scientists running the government. It's kind of absolutely, you know, bless her. I mean, I think, you know, many people in this room are already thinking, oh, what does she want? Cadres of physicists running the government, heaven forfend. That's not what he's advocating. He has a clear sense on the basis of his own advisory experience of the ways in which government committees of informed individuals can work together. Interesting. Make that page up. Turn over. Thank you. Yes, it takes. can work together towards the consensus. Phew!
I just think you have another little glass of water. I mean, it's all right if you lose the beginning, but if you lose your conclusion.
Right. He has a clear sense, on the basis of his own experience, of the way in which government advisory committees and informed individuals can work together towards a consensus. But their capacity to deliver agreed verdicts in matters of science, on which decisions can reliably be based, depends on there being enough of them who understand how scientific argument works. Snow maintains that all those in positions of power and influence ought to be able to evaluate proposals put to them which involve science and technology. It may not, of course, be possible for those in power to master the arguments themselves, but they have to surround themselves with a good enough scientific background to follow the reasoning processes by which the proposed course of action was arrived at. The way to achieve this is to include science alongside art and literature at the heart of the education received by everyone. That's where he arrives. Here then is the argument as an argument which not only deserved to be taken more seriously in 1959, but one which continues to need to be taken seriously today. 50 years on, Snow's ominous prophecy of a governing class lacking the competence to make informed policy choices where science and technology are concerned, continue to reverberate. In recent debates about GM crops, nuclear energy, and climate change, the public at large, and I include governments and senior administrators, have shown themselves liable to be swayed by the most persuasive of the advisors or interest groups because they are unable to judge for themselves either the soundness of the scientific arguments or the data that supports them. And this is the only point at which I will venture the teeniest reference to my current role on the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority. I cannot believe how little our great media journalists grasp on even the most basic elements of cell biology that would allow them to make sensible comments on things we do right or wrong. Yeah, I set myself to educate the public about assisted reproduction, and you discover that you have to educate the journalist first about elementary science, and that's the bottom line. But let's not stop there. For my conclusion, just to drive home Snow's all too relevant message, I just want to return for a moment to the post-war period in which Snow framed his original so-called two cultures argument, for one last story to underline the gravity of the situation he addressed as he understood it. Many of you know this story, but it's the phrasing I wanted to listen for. In March 1945, as it became increasingly clear that the United States government was inclining towards the use of the newly developed atomic bomb, Einstein wrote a letter of introduction to President Roosevelt on behalf of the most senior scientist working on the secret development of the bomb, Leo Szilard. Szilard had become increasingly concerned that those in government simply did not understand that the atomic bomb was not just a bigger bomb delivering a greater megaton payload, but was an explosive device of an entirely different order and kind, whose consequences were, according to Szilard's scientifically informed understanding, unthinkable if used upon us against the civilian population. In Einstein's letter, he explained that because of the secret nature of Szilard's work, that's that reference in Remembering Snow's Science of Government to men deciding in secret, because everything to do with bombing, strategic bombing, was entirely secret during the war. Because of the secret nature of Szilard's work, neither he, Einstein, nor Szilard himself was in a position to explain to the president, in a letter, quite how catastrophic the use of the bomb on civilian targets would be. Catastrophic beyond what was imaginable to anyone without first-hand understanding of the science behind it. He therefore urged Roosevelt to see Szilard in person and hear his concerns at first hand. And this is the last paragraph of his letter. The terms of secrecy under which Dr. Szilard is working at present do not permit him to give me the information. The terms of secrecy under which Dr. Szilard is working at present do not permit him to give me information about his work. However, I understand that he now is greatly concerned about the lack of adequate contact between scientists who are doing this work and those members of your cabinet who are responsible for formulating policy. In the circumstances, I consider it my duty to give Dr. Szilard this introduction, and I wish to express the hope you will be able to give his presentation of the case your personal attention. Now, as we all know, Einstein's letter states with particular urgency the matter that Snow urges upon us all to consider. It is the lack of adequate contact between scientists who are doing the work and members of the cabinet who are responsible for formulating policy that poses the greatest danger of the wrong policy decisions being taken in matters where there is considerable scientific content. And as we all know, it's probably one of the tragedies of the 20th century that President Roosevelt died only 2 weeks later, before he had met Szilard, although an appointment had been made with his wife, Eleanor. From Snow's perspective, President Truman's decision to use the bomb twice on the civilian population at Hiroshima and Nagasaki the following August was the most powerful example that could be produced, but of course not mentioned, of the absolute necessity for permanently and irrevocably bridging the two cultures divide. This is a Felix Topolsky that Dan Topolsky gave me for this occasion. We find ourselves here this evening in Snow's own college, 50 years after he launched his appeal for an integrated art, science, culture, and curriculum for all, a matter on which, in his view, the very future of Britain depended. It's my own view, it is in my own view, high time that we renewed and intensified our efforts to realise that as yet quite unachieved goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
I think that's probably rather a productive lecture to produce several questions. Possibly I've been very kindly agreed to attempt to answer or comment on points raised.
So questions? So first one here from Professor Sibley.
Thank you very much. Actually splendid. You made no mention of 1964 and Al Gross and White.
Yeah, very good.
Technology. I wonder why.
Because I stopped in 1961-62. That's the next chapter, but Georgia. I mean, yes, that was the next Labour government. I'd have things to say about that. But I think that I would now see, let me just see what would I say that would be helpful. This piece of work has made me think about Wilson's key statements in a very different light. And equally, it makes me see in a very different light the energy with which Wilson courted scientists to come into government, many of whom, like my father, refused. But he courted them. And he, so the answer, well, I haven't got an answer yet, but you're absolutely right. That's the next step. George wants to.
As you know, Lisa, I had the privilege of giving the first Snow lecture. And just two contributory footnotes. Part of the awful leavers business was Snow the novelist. Mm-hmm. That was absolutely crucial to the odium geologicum on the debate. That was bad luck, terrible bad luck. The second thing is more complicated. We saw a lot of Charles in those days. He was mesmerized by the Soviet Union. I use my word carefully. Naively, stupidly mesmerized. And kept saying to us, there was the model of an educational system where science, mathematics, I'm not qualified to say it was right or wrong. It was a very important factor in the way he thought about the future.
That's tremendously helpful. Tremendously helpful. The first point cannot be overstated. You know, William Waldegrave wrote a piece in the Times last week about the Snow Two Carters debate. And it started out with something like, of course, Snow is an awful novelist. I mean, you know, how do you start a discussion? With a critical judgment about work that nobody who's listening has read. So I'm not defending these novels, although I really do think that in Science and Government, it's a cracking good story about his argument to that. Really cracking. The way he dramatizes that is absolutely spectacular. So, you know, it really, because you can see that it turned out to be an argument that I found myself very invested in myself, it was just desperate that what had got fixed on was the idea that Snow really wanted to write literature, and that's what this, you know, and did it badly. You know, so that's that one. Now, in a way, the second one is another part of the same thing that you're saying, which is that the really, really interesting thing about Science and Government, did they ever remember, in 1961 in North America, is he can't do the Russia bit. Right? So it's a sort of aerated argument, because he really does attend to North America and Britain, and there's a lot of extremely interesting stuff in those lectures, but he never mentions Russia, presumably because he wasn't allowed to. And therefore, so yes, absolutely right on both counts. I think what I beg, particularly the younger people who barely know who Snow is, and certainly never read any of this stuff, is to sort of, he's a terrific writer of the intellectual one-liner. If you can find the one-liners in what he writes and overlook the sort of somewhat ill-advised digressions, whenever he gets up into his stride, it gets awful. But when he comes back to those key moments, many of which I have quoted, it is such a serious argument, and it really is one that we need to address again. But thank you very much.
David Cleaver, I'm just started as standing director of the Centre for Science and Policy here at the University of Cambridge. But my question isn't so much about science, but it's about engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that a lot of what you said could be similarly applied to a lot of government decisions about engineering, many of which are perhaps of immediate and larger economic import as far as the national health or transport or any other things concerned. And you didn't mention engineering at all. Neither did Snow, really, in those terms. Was thinking about science, and you mentioned pure science many times. Do you think that that's another problem that we're not really talking enough about?
I think that may have been the rhetoric of this lecture. One of the things that interests me about the science come out of the war years, of course, it's entirely applied. Nobody had any interest in anybody just splitting the atom. It had to make a bomb, right? And that is very, very clear. I'm just about to collect the number 850. On the way down, I read an extremely interesting article called Scientists and the Legacy of World War II, The Case of Operations Research. And fabulous. And I wish I'd read it before I'd finished writing this lecture, because
The bit that I wasn't quite getting in the lecture is that, which everyone here, who, and there are scientific advisors, I will avoid catching the eye of all the scientific advisors, is that the issue is not so much the integrity or cleverness or good advice of an individual man, it's well or woman, if we wish, but the way in which their work integrates and dovetails, which of course is the operations research strand, the way that they fit together and produce an environment within which the applications, technology, engineering, the scientific input, which actually seems to me to be rather small, pure science. I kept saying pure science because I was worried that if I said science, it wouldn't sound sort of strong enough. So, well, that was a bit... I know, I'm sorry. Actually, my husband made me put pure science in but there is an issue there, right? I don't think it's one that can't be got around in this discussion. I do think the highly complex area of discussion of how all of these things fit together, the input of the science and the output of the engineering and technology, is extremely important, and I think we lost that too in this country. And this article is about how North America mastered it, and we never got it.
There's three questions here, so the first one from
Thank you very much for a most interesting lecture. I'd like to begin by saying that I took part in the debate in the Union within the last two or three weeks, and I began by saying that I had no objection to being ruled by an elite, provided it consisted exclusively of women. that found some favour with parts of the audience. But what I'd like to say now is to emphasise the question about engineering.
Yes.
Because engineering, as particularly as taught at this university, its role is to solve human problems by reference to every branch of conceivable knowledge. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the engineers are the best. So I'm suggesting
we
have a
ton
of female engineers.
Right.
Like my granddaughter.
Right.
But let me finish by saying that I think engineering is the ideal academic discipline because it combines the rigorous reasoning of science with the bloody-mindedness of life.
Well, you will be, I hope, glad to hear that two of my three children did engineering at Cambridge. they're not the girl. If I could answer that seriously, well, I mean, it is the same answer, it is the last question. I think what I left out was this area of integration which Snow understood perfectly well, of the way in which the science and engineering came together. The reason he understood it so well was because that was what 1939 and 1945 had been all about. What I'm saying is the reason we lost that clear understanding was because we wouldn't talk about 1939 and 1945 where science and engineering was concerned.
There's quite a lot in his lecture about the inequalities of the developed and developing world.
Yes.
And I believe he was originally going to entitle the lecture The Rich and the Poor.
Yes.
Had he done that, I suspect we would not be talking about it 50 years later.
When I started work with this lecture, Martin, I thought that was what I was going to talk about. Anyone who's heard me give a public platform lecture knows that I take these things seriously and I start a new train of thought and I arrive somewhere I didn't expect to be. I absolutely believed that the way in which I would take on, as it were, the preciosity of the discussions that had gone on and the parochialism of them was to talk about the rich and the poor, and I even thought I was going to call it Readers in the Discussion of the Rich and the Poor. George humbled me to the fact that when he's talking about the rich and the poor, he makes
communist Russia his ideal state. So I couldn't do that. And it's not that I only didn't take it very long, and actually this other strand became important to me much more quickly, but that was what happened to me. I couldn't pursue that strand. But that was where the little interjection I made about how if you were an immigrant child, you could master science, technology, engineering, you could not reach the elite through the traditional route. That was what I thought I was going to think about what it meant to have continued to privilege as the sort of Brahmin ranking, if you look at the civil service or a government, specialisms and expertises which can only be gained by a certain privileged sort of person.
Thanks, Roger. Lisa, several points in your lecture, you referred to this as being a British phenomenon. This suggests that some others have got it right. Who's got it right, and how did they do it?
That's a really good question. Oh, I'm actually scary with what we speak on right. I do think North America does it better. I'm sorry. And I think that is integrates its science. But what... in this article, which I'm now clinging to. The suggestion there is that at the end of the war, America, North America, was in a position where its science and the operations research side of it, in terms of strategic discussions, went on inside very large scientific organizations that were government funded but at arm's length from government. And they didn't have Lord Sherwell's, they didn't have privileged individuals able to access along a particular axis. And their suggestion is two authors. Their suggestion is that meant that a more complicated relationship had to be built from the beginning than in Britain. I think I do now believe. That's really embarrassing for me, but no, that's not so embarrassing. I began as a scientist. I wasn't a good enough mathematician to finish the maths tripos, and I went on to the humanities. I then drifted back into history of science, which the science of scientists would say is where, you know, second-rate scientists end up, you know. I now, therefore, am a very senior figure in a humanities faculty in which I am completely devastated by the lack of science and mathematics among really highly qualified, not so young people. So I think I can't say who's got it right, but I know I'm damn sure we've got it wrong. I had a young member of staff in tears last week because I asked her to do percentages. I mean, you may laugh, but I mean, this is, you know, it's damn serious, guys. She said she would do it if we put buns on tables. You know, we're back in the primary classroom. And she has many higher degrees, and it's quite formidable, but has no embarrassment. It's socially acceptable. It's completely. But that's not really my. That's not what troubles me. What troubles me is she really can't do it. Right? That's what really troubles me. And just let me say something more on that, because I am now thinking much more about myself than the Snow lecturer. I spend almost every day of the week batting back the Sun or the Mirror or one of the newspapers who say, you say that there's a 17% risk that if you do this, if the genetic does this, the risk will be increased by 20%, and they
rattle off all these statistics at me. I mean, things that they picked up from our transparent website that have everything on it. And they just don't understand anything at all about what that means in numbers, for patients, in terms of real danger or success rates. You know, I mean, there is a 30% success rate for IVF, right? 1 in 3. And yet, every person you speak to believes that they're going to be in, they're going to come out of the, to live with the baby. That means they don't understand statistics. But I'm using a pivot because I'm thinking on a, I'm not really a nobody example, but I do think that we have a real problem. And when I get visiting students in from Germany, particularly from, and from Holland, they don't have this problem. From Scandinavia, they don't have this problem. I do think it's our problem. North American young people can do that.
A final question from the humanities.
Oh, you're giving me away. Lisa, I love your story of the immigrant child and the latency and valency of that in the educational context. There are people working on a CP Snow again. Some might even be here. But I guess it is in the humanities. So I don't know what the question is quite, except that rather bleak note, is it any different from 1951? Is there any kind of political dynamic across the disciplines which made you think there's any more hope, really, for that dynamic between the two cultures than in the 1951 analysis?
I'm never bleak. I'm the world's greatest optimist. We'll figure it. I just think, you know, the human race finds a way through. George doesn't believe it. But that's his privilege. I do believe it. I think, as I tread very carefully, I think we've got to take another look at education. I know, look, for Naben next year is thinking, oh God, another look, you know, another pull it out of the ground, look at the roots and say it's not growing very well and put it back again. But other countries do it better, so that might be a start. But am I wrong? Or as, you know, people's children and grandchildren, you know, who are at a level of general education, they can't, well, some of them can't, you are a plug, actually. That's your engineering, as it were, as the applied sciences. I used to be a governor, or let's lighten the mood. Julia knows this. I've always been a governor of numerous state schools, and when my child, who's contemporary of her child, was in primary school, I was a governor, and I used to sit on the governors, and they'd bring in young woman after young woman for interview, and they'd say, she does leaf painting, and she plays the flute, and she can teach them line dancing, and I'd say, can you teach them how a lavatory flush is? And they'd go, boom, no, that's not. It just seems to me that wiring a plug and knowing how to plug through plug is quite a good starting point for a six-year-old, you know. But then they're going to learn leaf painting and fine dancing.
I think we should thank the Casey Snow's lecture in the sense of Banks and Goethe, I suppose, at the end of the Second World War. And it is a fascinating question to ask whether there are other effects as well as that that keep the divide or the difference in Britain as it is. I must say, amongst the undergraduates and graduate students that I deal with, globalisation of various sorts is the main antidote. When people come from other cultures in and observe this divide, it looks strange and they mitigate it. Before I ask this, thank Lisa, the buttery bar manager was asking to let you know, if you want to get a drink and carry on discussing the lecture, then the buttery bar is on the left as you walk through the first course. With that, to our school, thank you for your lecture.
I have to turn it off. Yeah, I wasn't going to make
this lecture is the...
This is it.